On December 7, 1941, the Japanese military attacked Pearl Harbor, plunging the U.S. into World War II. The war enjoyed widespread popular support in the United States. In August 1945, the United States dropped the first atomic bombs on Japan. At the time, most Americans supported the bombing because it finally ended the war. But the decision remains controversial, in no small part because of the subsequent history of nuclear arms. On this public radio special, Lessons of Hiroshima 60 Years Later, we'll go back to the World War II years to hear the stories of an American soldier, a Japanese war veteran, and atomic bomb survivors. We'll learn how the United States government officially censored news of the bomb's impact and why the United States began its nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. We'll hear from a former Secretary of Defense about how the United States could have started a nuclear war by accident. Later in the program, you'll hear my interview with International Atomic Energy Agency head Mohammed El-Baradei about nuclear proliferation and my personal reflections about the Hiroshima bomb and its aftermath. I'm your host, Walter Cronkite. We begin this special one-hour documentary with a look back on how the United States came to drop the first atomic bomb. It's produced by Reese Ehrlich.
My fellow Americans, the sudden criminal attacks perpetrated by the Japanese in the Pacific provide the climax of a decade of international immorality. Powerful and resourceful gangsters have banded together to make war upon the whole human race. Their challenge has now been flung at the United States of America.
The country was pretty well unified behind the war effort.
Lincoln Grafs was 19 when he heeded calls from President Franklin Roosevelt and volunteered for the Navy. He says in those days, fascism posed a direct threat to the U.S. and others around the world.
When people tell me, you're so great, you're a hero because you were in World War II, my reaction is, well, so what? My whole generation was involved. There were 16 million of us. Quite literally, if you saw a man in his early 20s walking down the street in civilian clothes, he was abused in those days.
War crimes committed by the German army are well known. Perhaps less well known are the atrocities committed by the Japanese occupying forces in Asia. Yoshio Suzuki was drafted in 1941 and served in the Japanese army as an infantryman, mostly in China.
Basically, our military training taught us not to see Chinese as human. They were the same as dogs and cats. If you think of people as human, you can't kill them, even if you want to. Sometimes to drive the point home, they tied a live prisoner to a pillar and we practiced stabbing someone to death. I was made to do this.
Fighting such a merciless enemy, the U.S. and its allies adopted a now controversial strategy of total war. The U.S. intentionally bombed civilians in an effort to weaken enemy morale. That included the firebombing of Dresden, Germany, and in February 1945, the U.S. began firebombing Tokyo and other Japanese cities, which resulted ultimately in more civilian deaths than the atomic bombs dropped later that year. Robert McNamara, who later became Secretary of Defense in the 1960s, was a young officer who helped plan those raids. He describes the moral issues facing himself and General Curtis LeMay in the documentary film Fog of War.
In order to win a war, should you kill 100,000 people in one night by firebombing or any other way? LeMay's answer would be clearly yes. McNamara, do you mean to say that instead of burning to death 100,000 Japanese civilians in that one night, we should have burned to death a lesser number or none, and then had our soldiers cross the beaches in Tokyo and been slaughtered in the tens of thousands? Is that what you're proposing? Is that moral?
McNamara says that history is always kind to the winner.
LeMay said if we'd lost the war, we'd all have been prosecuted as war criminals. And I think he's right. He, and I'd say I, were behaving as war criminals.
The U.S. efforts to develop an atomic bomb fit into the total war policy. Initially, the U.S. worried that German scientists were developing an atomic bomb. But after the Nazi surrender, the U.S. learned that, in fact, the Germans had no real atomic bomb program. John Dower, a history professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, says the U.S. continued its program nevertheless.
By April 1945, the Germans were out of the war, and we couldn't stop because we now had the new weapons. After the Germans surrendered, we redoubled our efforts because we were afraid the war would end before we could bring this to a conclusion. Then you get into incredible, what we call technological imperatives, psychological imperatives.
On August 6, 1945, the U.S. dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and 3 days later used another on Nagasaki. President Harry Truman addressed the nation on radio.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in the first attack to avoid, in so far as possible, the killing of civilians.
In fact, Hiroshima had a few military factories and soldiers, but the city was not a military base. The U.S. dropped the bomb on Nagasaki because the original target city of Kokura was obscured by bad weather and the pilot was running out of fuel. Over 200,000 people were killed in the attacks, mostly civilians.
Had I been Secretary of War at the time, knowing what I knew, knowing what Secretary Stimson knew, I believe I would have taken the same actions that he took.
William Perry was Secretary of Defense from 1994 to 1997 and is now a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
The reason for that is simple and straightforward, I think, given that Japan is not surrendering, and that is the casualties that would have been imposed not just on the United States forces but on Japanese by an invasion of Japan dwarfed the casualties that were affected by the dropping of the bombs.
Perry says the U.S. had just fought a fierce battle on the Japanese island of Okinawa, a precursor to what the U.S. would have faced in a direct invasion of the Japanese mainland.
In the Battle of Okinawa, we had 50,000 American casualties. We lost more than 30 ships. That was bad enough, but the Japanese lost about 200,000. Very few Japanese soldiers were taken prisoners. Those who were not killed, many of them committed suicide. Many of the civilians committed suicide. So that fanatical, last-ditch, die-hard defense, which we saw on Okinawa, I think we would have seen on Japan.
But what seemed like a reasonable military decision in Washington looked very different on the ground in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Retired schoolteacher Masahito Hirose explains that the bomb exploded very close to where he's now standing.
The actual bomb exploded 500 meters above the ground. So this is really right underneath where it exploded because it was up so high. In the playing ground right behind us, there were about 1,500 children who had just come out of the air raid shelters and were playing. They were all killed, not a single one survived. And the heat was so intense that their bodies just burned within that second or two. They say when you look at this ground here now, if you came within several days, several weeks, the whole ground was covered with bodies. You couldn't see anything but bodies of children.
Akio Sakita, who was 16, says that day is seared in his mind as well.
I saw an orange-colored fireball rise in the sky. It looked almost as big as the size of the sun. It did not emit a blinding flash right away, but within a second, beams in many colors, red, blue, and yellow, suddenly started to spread in every direction from the orange-colored fireball. It hit my face, so I felt great pain. I just touched my face, and then I felt my skin come off my face and hang down.
Survivors describe streets filled with severely burned victims, pleading for water. Keiko Ogura, who was only 8 years old at the time, brought them some.
Some of them, after drinking, saying thank you and drank water, and soon after they died in front of me. that made me scared. I felt so guilty. That kind of guilty feeling continuously made me so sad. So many years, I don't know, still now, maybe 40 years or 50 years, I always recall that dreadful sight, dreadful experience.
For a time, Sakue Shimohira, age 10, lived with her two younger siblings in a bomb shelter, really a cave dug into the side of a mountain. After the Nagasaki bomb fell, she went back to try to find her house.
Finally, we found a house with a crumbled gate. We thought it might have been our house. We were not sure, but we moved rubble away and found a charred dead body whose eyes were covered by the person's hands. We turned the dead body over and moved the hands aside. An unburned part of the face was revealed. It was our older sister.
Shimohira says the bodies continued to glow because the radiation affected the bone calcium.
It was 7-8 months afterwards. The ashes were still giving off a glowing light from the phosphorus in the bones. We called them corpse candles.
The Nagasaki residents didn't know what caused the eerie glow. Some thought it was the spirit of the dead. Radiation sickness caused tens of thousands to die or be permanently deformed. However, the destruction in Hiroshima and Nagasaki was largely hidden from the world. U.S. occupation authorities initially banned any news stories. The first photos of civilian casualties didn't appear in Japan until 1952, 7 years after the end of the war. Historian John Dower.
So as part of a more general censorship policy, writings about the effects of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were basically censored by the American occupation authorities. Photographs taken by Japanese were ordered to be turned in to the Americans. And the film footage which the Americans took from the immediate aftermath of the bombs was held secret by the Americans until the 1960s.
And since journalists weren't allowed to report from the bombed cities, the censorship effectively extended worldwide. A few courageous journalists defied the censorship in 1945, but most cooperated fully. One leading journalist for the New York Times reported on the atomic bomb while simultaneously writing press releases for the War Department about the lack of danger from radiation. Walter Cronkite had firsthand experience with those restrictions when he covered Hiroshima for CBS News in 1958.
In Hiroshima, I saw the results of the bombing, a flattened city, a destroyed city, a population that was still walking around in a daze, quite honestly. It was in a city that didn't exist. The people, you wondered where they came from because there was no housing, no nothing. I'd seen bombed out cities in Germany and indeed where the Germans started it in England. There wasn't anything of semblance of what the atomic bomb did. We were not permitted to film. We could tell what we saw, but we didn't have any pictures to back it up. And with the television, that's a no-no.
Today, journalists in Japan say that had the press been doing its job, it could have impacted the nuclear arms race. Akira Tashiro is a veteran reporter for the Hiroshima Daily Chugoku Shimbun.
If the same thing had happened today with this advancement of media and technologies, if they televised the consequence of the atomic bombing right after the bombing for a few days or so, probably there wouldn't be the nuclear arms race between the United States and the former Soviet Union. Actually, the majority of the people of the world really don't know what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I'm Maurice Ehrlich.
You're listening to Lessons from Hiroshima 60 Years Later, a public radio documentary distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Coming up, how the legacy of Hiroshima impacted both Japanese civilians and American GIs. How close did the United States come to launching an accidental nuclear strike? And hear my interview with International Atomic Energy Agency head Mohammed El-Baradei about today's danger of nuclear proliferation. I'm your host, Walter Cronkite. More after this. For 7 years after the dropping of the bombs on Japan in 1945, the United States occupying authorities censored any news of the impact of atomic radiation on survivors. But American scientists were studying those effects. Reese Ehrlich continues the story.
U.S. and Japanese scientists quickly learned that the after effects of radiation exposure were truly horrendous. People who survived the blast with no apparent injuries suddenly became icy cold and died. Others faced lifelong medical horrors. Mr. Akio Sakita was a teenager living in Nagasaki in 1945.
Since the explosion, I have been in and out of the hospital around 17 times. My stay varied in length from as short as 2 or 3 months and as long as 2 or 3 years. During that time, I underwent many operations while hospitalized. I had 30 centimeters of my large intestine removed and both my thighs were operated on.
The Hibakusha were not the only ones exposed to radiation from atomic blasts.
Second, all of the observer ships are in position in the open sea. We're about 10 miles away. I
fire the target.
4, 3... 2, 1.
The atomic bomb exploded at 8:35 a.m. Bikini time. I will make my first official statement on results in about 2 hours from now.
In 1946, Lincoln Grafs was stationed on board a Navy salvage tug at the Bikini Atoll during the first post-war atomic tests.
We were 9 miles away when each of the bombs was detonated. There were two bombs that summer. One was an airdrop, and then 3 weeks later, the second one was an underwater shot. After each one of those, 4 hours later, we were back inside the lagoon alongside the target vessels, putting out fires and doing whatever we could to keep the ships afloat so that survey crews could go aboard them later and assess the damage.
From their studies of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, U.S. military scientists were well aware of the dangers of exposure at a nuclear explosion site, yet the Navy never informed its sailors.
We were told very little, but we were told about the dangers, you know, in kind of a vague way. You have to understand, when you're in your early 20s, you're invincible, at least in your own mind. So we used to joke about things. We used to joke about being exposed to radiation. Ha, 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 you know, we'll go back and tell all the girls that we're sterile.
You got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
We had no protective clothing. We were the first wave of manned ships back into that lagoon. We ran around that lagoon all summer. We pumped up water that was contaminated with radioactivity and ran it through our evaporators to make fresh water that was used for drinking, cooking, washing clothes. We didn't have much choice. We were ordered to be there, and if we didn't like it, there was an awful lot of ocean to walk across between there and Pearl Harbor if we wanted to get away.
Within a few months of this intense exposure, some of his friends were showing signs of radiation sickness. Grafs himself developed a large abscess on his face.
I had a high fever, and they gave me a blood test and discovered that my white count was way out of whack. They gave me all the usual things like massive doses of penicillin and hot Epsom salts, soaks, and things of that sort. Nothing would touch it. And finally, one day, they took me down to X-ray. And this old Navy doctor said to me, "Son, we're going to give you a..." When I was an old country doctor, they called it a hair of the dog that bit you. And they covered my eye with a lead shield, and they hit this thing with X-ray. I got two of those treatments, and the abscess went away. Somewhat later, my white count started evening out. Then, for the next 6 to 8 months, I had boils all over my body. Nobody ever told me that they connected it with radioactivity. In my service record, it doesn't say anything about radiation sickness.
And like the Hibakusha, the radiation exposure affected the next generation.
My daughter, who was conceived about a year after I was exposed, had trouble all through her teenage years with her endocrine system. She had half of her pancreas removed because of growths when she was 20 years old, and she ultimately died with a brain tumor. Her daughter, in turn, was born with a deformed foot.
Some Hibakusha share the same fate. As a result, many Japanese discriminated against residents from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hiroshima bomb survivor Keiko Ogura was a teenager after the war.
And as soon as I said, "I'm from Hiroshima," and then other children started to look at me, stare at me. Later, some young people moved into Hiroshima City, and I asked, "Was there any warning from your mother or parents that not to get married at Hiroshima girls?" And most of the young people said, "Yes, my parents, mother especially, told me, be careful." So I didn't know about the discrimination.
But few Americans knew much about the effect of radiation on either the Japanese or American GIs. They were getting a very different message from the government and the media.
Town meeting tonight from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Are you worried about the atomic bomb? Hear all sides and make up your own mind.
This town hall radio program was typical of the information Americans were getting in the early 1950s. There was a nuclear danger, and it came from the Soviet Union. Dr. Ralph Lapp worked on the Manhattan Project that developed the first atomic bomb.
Make no mistake about it, the Soviets are stockpiling A-bombs at an increasing pace. They have the bombers and the submarines and the agents to deliver the bombs to our shores.
Former Defense Secretary William Perry says in reality, the U.S. always had atomic superiority over the Soviet Union, both in absolute number of bombs and ability to deliver them. The U.S. nuclear arsenal served another purpose, according to Perry. The USSR had a larger army and numerical superiority in some conventional weapons. Back in the 1950s, Perry says President Eisenhower was given a choice by the generals.
To enforce both containment and deterrence, which were the policies of the United States, you need to increase the size of the army substantially. Eisenhower specifically considered that and specifically rejected it. He rejected it on the basis that it would cripple the economy of the United States. And indeed, if you look over a long period of history, that's eventually was a major factor in the crippling of the economy of the Soviet Union, because they did maintain this huge army. So Eisenhower decided, I think wisely, not to make that increase in the army. But at the same time he made that, he said, we will offset the Soviet superiority in conventional weapons with our superiority in nuclear weapons. That was an explicit judgment that he made shortly after he became president. And that was the policy of American presidents, both Republican and Democrat, for many administrations after that.
Fortunately, the U.S. and Soviet Union never did use nuclear weapons against one another. They came very close during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Perhaps less well known is how a nuclear crisis almost erupted in the Middle East. The Kennedy administration had opposed Israel developing nuclear weapons, but with help from France in the late 1960s, Israel secretly built nuclear bombs and the means to deliver them. Aaron Tovish, manager of the Mayor's Campaign for Peace in Hiroshima, describes what happened in the 1973 war between Israel and Arab countries.
During the Yom Kippur War, Israelis were caught by surprise, and they got in touch with Washington, and Kissinger told them that, well, we can resupply you, but it's going to take a little time. And Golda Meir, through various channels, got back to him and said, we don't have time. We're arming our nuclear missiles, so I just want to let you know it's that desperate.
Tovish notes that the Nixon administration speeded up the supply of ammunition and spare parts to Israel.
Israel was able to reverse the situation on the battlefield, and the missiles were taken off of alert. But there was a moment there where Israel at least appeared to be prepared to draw the entire world into a nuclear holocaust. This type of situation could develop again with any number of countries, and so we should be very thankful we made it through that Cold War period when there was such a level of readiness to launch massive numbers of nuclear weapons.
During the Cold War, the U.S. and Soviet Union were prepared to launch nuclear weapons within minutes. So back then, and even today, there is a danger of an accidental nuclear attack. William Perry says he knows of three or four such incidents, including one that happened to him in the late 1970s, when he was an Undersecretary of Defense in the Carter administration.
I received a call from the general who was a watch officer at the North American Air Defense Command at that time. It must have been at 3 o'clock in the morning, telling me that his computers were indicating that there were 200 missiles on the way from the Soviet Union to the United States. So I have a very vivid recollection of that incident. He was thinking it was a computer malfunction. It turned out it was not that. It was a human error. An operator had put a training tape into the computer, and the training tape is designed to look like a real launch, of course.
Perry says in that case, the error was caught early. But he notes that for many years, the world lived within 15 minutes of nuclear war.
From North American Air Defense Command back to the president, that whole system for getting the decision made, we had about 15 minutes to make it. That's why it was so dangerous. We were on a hair trigger alert.
Mohammed El-Baradei is Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN body that oversees such issues as nuclear proliferation. Before the 2003 Iraq War, Dr. El-Baradei correctly pointed out that Saddam Hussein no longer had a nuclear weapons program. But because that position ran counter to assertions by the United States, Dr. El-Baradei earned the anger of the Bush administration. I had an opportunity to sit down with Dr. El-Baradei at the UN headquarters in New York for a wide-ranging discussion of the dangers of nuclear proliferation and future prospects for disarmament. I began the interview by asking if any one country poses a grave threat in spreading nuclear weapons.
North Korea have the nuclear material that can directly go into a nuclear weapon. They have the industrial infrastructure. They made it clear that they are bent on developing nuclear weapon. They have the missile capability to deliver a nuclear weapon. So for me, North Korea is the number one security threat or challenge to the non-proliferation regime. Then there are other countries, as you mentioned, for example, Iran, where some people suspect that they have the intention to develop a nuclear weapon. This is a matter of concern, clearly, to us, but it is not the imminent threat that we are facing in the case of North Korea. I read recently the estimate by the U.S. intelligence saying that Iran, should they want to develop a nuclear weapon, will take them 5 to 6 years, at least the beginning of the next decade. So we have time for diplomacy. We have time for dialogue.
What is your estimation of the European effort to negotiate a settlement with the Iranians on this nuclear issue?
I think it's a very laudable exercise. I have been supporting that approach. I've been, in fact, asking for the last few months the U.S. to do all the heavy lifting in support of the European initiative. What we see, the nuclear program, is the tip of the iceberg. It really masks a complex relationship between Iran and the rest of the international community, particularly with the U.S., with Europe since the hostage time. It masks a sense of insecurity, a sense of isolation, economic boycott, trade restrictions. So what we need is to, again, not unlike North Korea, to get all the parties together, to put all their grievances on the table and to try to agree on a package that is perceived by all of them to be fair and equitable. But we also need Iran to assure the international community that their program, you know, is really to produce electricity and not for any military application. And I think that's what the Europeans are trying to do. It is going to be frustrating. It is going to be a long time. But this is the only way to go to resolve this sort of issues, which has to do with security.
Clearly, you're on the other side of the United States position that it's holding open the option of a military attack on Iran if it doesn't, of course, meet us our conditions. How do you face that?
I don't really think, Mr. Cronkite, that any of these issues can be resolved by military action. You might delay a country's program through military action, but it could backfire. If you humiliate a country, if you jolt their sense of pride, you might end up doing exactly the same by forcing them in a crash program to develop a nuclear weapon program. I know that the Israelis destroyed the Iraq research reactor in 1982, but I also know that Saddam Hussein immediately afterward went underground with a massive clandestine nuclear weapon program. So I'm not sure that this type of situation are amenable to resolution through military force.
It's said that Israel has 200 atomic weapons. Do you have the same concern about that as you do about the proliferation of weapons in, for instance, Iran, North Korea, and so forth?
As a Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, I have no jurisdiction over Israel, India, or Pakistan because they are not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But as a responsible human being, of course I worry about any country that either have nuclear weapons or reported to have nuclear weapons. I had a good visit to Israel last summer. I had a good talk with Prime Minister Sharon, and I told him that in my view, we need to rid the Middle East from all nuclear weapons, Israeli weapons or programs included. That's my hope, that we will continue to work in parallel with the peace process in the Middle East to initiate a security dialogue.
The Non-Proliferation Treaty calls for serious negotiations toward disarmament by the major nuclear powers. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, many people expected greater progress. Have you been disappointed on that issue?
I don't understand why today, after, as you rightly said, end of the Cold War, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that we still have 27,000 warheads in existence in the world. I don't understand that why we continue to rely on nuclear weapons for our survival. 8 or 9 countries who are saying we are going to rely for our security on nuclear weapons, but nobody else should. This is a commitment they took under the Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1970. A lot of people feel very cynical. The earlier we can move to our nuclear disarmament, the earlier we can do a lot of take concrete measures to reduce the number of weapons in the arsenal, to de-emphasize the strategic role given to nuclear weapons, to bring a comprehensive test ban treaty that prohibits testing of nuclear weapons into force. The earlier we get a treaty that ban production of fissile material to military purpose, the more we can do to show the rest of the world, and I'm talking now about the weapon state, the more they can do to show the rest of the world that they are serious about their commitment to move toward nuclear disarmament, the more they will have a moral authority.
Mr. Bolton's often expressed contempt for the United Nations seems to have the full backing of President Bush. In your opinion, is this attitude by the U.S. seriously endangering the United Nations' future?
Multilateral diplomacy, the UN, is exactly like democracy. It's a very slow, it's a very frustrating, it's sometimes unwieldy, but it's still the best option because without multilateral diplomacy, without the UN, we are absolutely helpless. There is a limit to power, and I think people are coming to understand that no matter how much arsenal you have, no matter how much resources you have, we are living in a globalized world where we need to work all of us together in a cooperative way to resolve any of our problems. We are reaching a fork in the road. Either we are going to have a safe world when we can all live secure in dignity and in freedom, or we are going to go toward what President Kennedy predicted in 1960, a world full of nuclear weapon states, with the end that we will self-destruct as a result of accident or miscalculation.
You're listening to Lessons from Hiroshima 60 Years Later, a public radio documentary distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Coming up, the sometimes surprising reflections of Japanese bomb survivors, American GIs, and United States policymakers. And stay tuned for my commentary about the Hiroshima bomb and its aftermath. I'm your host, Walter Cronkite. More in a moment. Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs have profoundly affected the lives of everyone involved, whether war veterans, government decision makers, or hiabakusha. In this, the final segment of the documentary, we look at the modern legacy of nuclear arms as seen through the eyes of people we met earlier in the program. We begin with Nagasaki atomic bomb survivor Sakue Shimashira.
私たちは死ぬ勇気.
Survivors have struggled between finding the strength to live or finding the courage to commit suicide. My 9-year-old sister was overcome by poverty, disease, and longing for her mother, and she chose to commit suicide. I was now all alone, and I decided to die. I stood in front of an oncoming steam engine, but I became frightened as it approached me. I jumped away. Today, I am glad that I chose to live. I know how valuable life is. I want many people to understand how important peace is. I underwent 4 surgeries in my stomach due to being exposed to radiation. For 12 long years, no one gave us any aid or government support.
None of my family talked about that day, 6th of August, and we tried to forget.
Atomic bomb survivor Keiko Ogura helped found Translators for Peace in Hiroshima. Because she wasn't physically wounded, she thought she had overcome the trauma of August 6th. That is, until the day she accompanied a group of survivors in Washington, D.C. to see the Smithsonian exhibit of the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima.
All of a sudden, I saw Enola Gay. I felt like I was as if as an 8-year-old girl. And I was so scared. And I just continued to cry for 1 hour or so. I didn't know that so hidden unconscious fear in myself. I recall and I think about the children in Iraq and other so many countries and who had a very sad experience of fear. Even 60 years later, they will recall and react toward the fear. And so I just cried and was scared. I was asked, don't you hate American people? And at that time you hated American people, or do you have any anti-feeling toward American people? But to tell the truth, almost 99% of Hiroshima people, even though they lost their family, do not hate American original people. But I think they hate militarism.
War veteran Yoshio Suzuki now lives in retirement north of Tokyo. His personal experiences as a draftee during World War II have profoundly affected his life. While some Japanese remember the horror of being bombed, he has nightmares about the horrors he was forced to perpetrate against civilians in China.
There in the small room was a young woman about 25 or 26. Not knowing who it was, I flipped the blanket off of her with the stock of my gun. Next to the woman, who was shaking in fear, was a newborn baby. I was speechless, and I did pity them. But I went out and lit bundle after bundle of straw and threw them all into the room with the mother and her child. Then I slammed the door shut. Smoke billowed out from the windows, and I could hear the screams from inside.
Suzuki's experiences have made him a lifelong opponent of Japanese militarism. He supports the U.S. decision to drop the atomic bombs.
At the time, I was very bitter about it. But later, after studying the war in more depth, I came to believe that the U.S. had saved Japan. It's just what you would expect from a great country. If it hadn't been for the U.S., who knows how far Japan would have pursued the war. All the American attacks were conducted to vanquish Japanese militarism. They were good.
Suzuki also opposes current efforts for Japan to upgrade its army and station troops abroad. Under pressure from the U.S., Japan has sent troops to Iraq, the first such foreign commitment since the end of World War II.
I'm totally opposed. I was part of the occupying army in China, right? We have reverted to the position we were in when we occupied China. It is not a force just to keep the peace. I don't think we need an army.
The Japanese government has announced plans to withdraw its troops from Iraq, in part because of strong public opposition. U.S. Navy veteran Lincoln Graffs also went through personal tumult as a result of radiation exposure during the Bikini A-bomb tests.
I have non-malignant nodules on my thyroid, and I have had malfunctions of the thyroid, but it's fairly well regulated. I've had a lot of trouble with my digestive system, hypersensitivity of the lining of my digestive system. I'm fairly certain that they're associated with radiation exposure.
Graffs, now a leader in Veterans for Peace, has devoted a good portion of his life to examining the impact of atomic radiation on Americans.
One of the things that I discovered in my research was that almost everyone that I interviewed who had been Marines in the occupation of Nagasaki ended up with leukemia. You know, sometimes as much as 20 years later. And my feeling is this is a weapon that is deadly not only to the people you're using it against, but to the people who are using it. The United States gets all upset at the possibility that somebody is developing nuclear weapons. We have more nuclear weapons than anybody else. We're in a position to say, okay, let's start disarming. We don't have to cut down so that we have less than anybody, but we have the most. We can take the lead as long as we're in that dominant position.
William Perry was an Army officer who participated in the U.S. invasion of Okinawa in 1945. He later became Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration and today is a fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. He's a forceful proponent of a strong U.S. military. He says, however, that the U.S. and other nuclear powers have not lived up to their commitments under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
That treaty was based on a grand bargain, and the bargain was that the non-nuclear powers would abstain from becoming nuclear powers voluntarily, and that the nuclear powers would work towards a major reduction in their forces, ultimately heading towards a zero. It seems to me that we're not keeping our end of the bargain.
He also worries about the spread of nuclear weapons to other countries.
Every country that has gotten nuclear weapons has been guilty of what chess players call the fallacy of the last move. They think if only I had nuclear weapons, I could protect my security. But they think that's the last move. When India got nuclear weapons, it was to protect their security. And then Pakistan gets nuclear weapons. It's never the last move. When Israel gets nuclear weapons, that increases the impetus for Iraq and Iran to get nuclear weapons. Issues that we have dealt with at considerable cost and still have not adequately dealt with the ones. So for those reasons, I think it was a mistake for Israel to get nuclear weapons.
Back in Nagasaki, 82-year-old Fumiko Matsuda, whose son died from radiation sickness, now considers herself a peace activist.
I try to talk to the kids in my neighborhood. And when I get out of my car, then the kids in the neighborhood run to me. And I really, you know, love them, and I, you know, care about them, I cherish them, and I always talk to them. And this is how I try to sort of disseminate my feeling about peace. So I know that it is too much to call that peace activities. Mine is very, very basic. It is part of my daily life. The very first step of peace is there.
Across the river from Nagasaki's Ground Zero, fourth graders are working in their elementary school garden. Their school maintains a small museum about the atomic bomb and a garden commemorating the destruction of their school 60 years ago. One student stops weeding for a moment and eagerly answers the question, "What does peace mean to you?"
It means there a world where there's no war. Where there are no conflicts and oppression or discrimination. Where we're friendly with each other.
You've been listening to the stories of Japanese citizens, an American GI, and United States policymakers about the legacy of Hiroshima. I lived through that era as well, and I want to take a moment to offer my own reflections on these important issues. The bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were stunning and sobering events. They brought World War II to an end, and everyone was thankful for that, of course. Not too many of us stopped to think about the full implications of those bombs for our future. We were too busy celebrating the end of the terrible war. One of the people who had it absolutely right at the very beginning about the meaning of Hiroshima was the great French writer Albert Camus. He wrote in the French Resistance newspaper, "Our technological civilization has just reached its greatest level of savagery." In retrospect, we can say that United States leaders missed the opportunity to nip the arms race in the bud. Instead, within 4 years, the Soviet Union had tested its first nuclear weapon. Today, in the 60th year of the nuclear age, we still have some 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world, and some 4,000 of these are on hair-trigger alert. Not so incidentally, the United States has more nuclear weapons in its arsenal than any other nation. Today, there is much concern about the increasing numbers of nuclear weapons, and rightly so. The public is largely unaware that nuclear disarmament is a central component of the non-proliferation bargain. On the one hand, the non-proliferation treaty provides obligations to halt nuclear proliferation. On the other, it provides obligations to achieve nuclear disarmament. This makes good sense, for the two obligations are tightly interlinked. There has been much emphasis in the news about the dangers of nuclear proliferation. Unfortunately, the disarmament obligation of the nuclear weapon states receive far less attention in news reporting, at least within our United States. This may be because the continuing existence of our own vast arsenal doesn't seem to Americans, even if they are aware of it, to be nearly as dangerous as the threat of new nations acquiring the ghastly weapons. Frankly, I'm worried. It seems that the United States and the other nuclear weapon states are trying to evade their obligations and responsibilities under this critical non-proliferation treaty. Such behavior strains the credibility of these countries and actually encourages more nuclear weapons, including the development of so-called tactical nuclear weapons. The survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Hibakusha, have continually warned nuclear weapons and human beings cannot coexist. In the end, I believe this is the most important lesson of Hiroshima. We must eliminate nuclear weapons before they eliminate us. You've been listening to Lessons from Hiroshima 60 Years Later, a public radio documentary written and produced by Reese Ehrlich in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. The documentary is brought to you by Peace Talks. The show was funded in part by the Bequest and Chase Funds, Tyson Foundation, and Newtown Monthly Meeting. Special thanks to Peace Talks executive producer Barbara Simmons and Dr. Jennifer Beer, who gathered interviews in Japan, and to Kati Soyak. Thanks to Andy Lancet and radio station WNYC and the National Archives for use of historic audio. And thanks to the sound engineers at UN Radio and Duke Marcos Audio in New York. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. I'm your host, Walter Cronkite.
You can find more information about this program at peacetalksonline.org. That's peacetalksonline, all one word, .org.
PRI, Public Radio International.